now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix.
Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Well, this show is the Big 50, as in 50 commentaries, and I would like to thank the people behind the scenes who have helped make this all possible, as well as the loyal support of our listeners. We get great input, feedback, suggestions, timely and meaningful criticism at times, which is welcome, as opposed to just venomous, spiteful, hateful negativity, which I suppose every podcaster gets, well, depending on the subject matter, of course. We get good insight and good feedback from our listeners, and I'm biased, but I've said this before, I believe that our listeners are as switched on as they come. So today is the 50th, count them, 50 commentaries, and it's a milestone, and we're very proud of what we've accomplished in such a short time over here at the Cosmic Switchboard Show. I'd like to apologize for the heavy breathing that some of you have heard over the last couple or maybe even few podcasts and interviews. They've been chemtrailing the hell out of this place, and I've had flare-ups of asthma, and as you can probably tell, you can still hear my voice. It's still a little raw. I do appreciate those of you who made comments in the YouTubes and in the comment section elsewhere about the breathing, and I'll remind myself to either mute my microphone or move the microphone away from me when I'm not talking. Sometimes I get so engrossed in what our guests are saying that I forget. So I do appreciate you letting me know, and I do apologize for any inconvenience that the heavy breathing and the wheezing and all the other stuff related to the asthma may have caused you. And on the other hand, there are some people who were quite spiteful in their comments about the heavy breathing. And as far as those people are concerned, I think what it really comes down to is it's not so much the heavy breathing that bothered them. It's the fact that I was breathing at all, okay? I think that's the main beef some of those people have. So as far as those that were complaining about me just breathing, well, all I've got to say about that is, well, excuse me. Well, we've all heard about the so-called self-loathing Jew. A self-loathing Jew, so-called, is a Jew who calls out other Jews for committing misdeeds, hypocrisy, for lying, for causing problems, etc., etc., etc. The default setting that the tribalist collective has come up with to demonize and castigate someone from their own tribe who calls them out on their own BS is a self-loathing Jew. And in the recent past, I've had occasion to meet a couple of self-loathing Germans. And you have to understand, folks, if you want to completely whitewash and change, radically change the history of a given country, you make the people that have been victimized, the people that have been blown to hell and back, the people that have been mass murdered, and because the victors write the histories, the victors tell the story, you blame the victim, and you make them out to be the most evil people in the world. And this is reinforced in the schools, in the media, etc., etc., in the cinema especially, right? And I've had occasion in the recent past to meet some self-loathing Germans. One of my fields of study is the Second World War, military history. And when I study military history, and when I talk about military history, I do it without rancor, I do it without anger, I do it without resentment. I just speak my truth as I understand it, as I know my truth to be. But some of these self-loathing Germans, they don't even want the subject of the Second World War to come up because they just cringe in embarrassment. And especially some of these self-loathing Germans who've been excreted by the universities. I mean, they've just been imbued by the cultural Marxism. You go down the laundry list of mind control they've been subjected to. Cultural Marxism, check. Gender studies, check. Multicultural diversity, check. Global warming, check. Climate change, check. You just go down the list of all the brainwashing they've been subjected to. And then when you bring up, you know, subject matter relative to the German military and the history of Germanic warfare, they cringe, right? These two self-loathing Germans were proudly saying how, oh, you know, in this current war on terror, the Germans are not involved in active combat. They've only been used in a support role. Complete nonsense. KSK, Kommando Spezialkräfte, KSK, the elite German Army Special Forces, has been used in Afghanistan, and there have been reports of them being used in Syria, all right? So, but, you know, these Germans that are all shame-based, brainwashed, they don't want to talk about that. And so they're basically shame-based Germans. They're self-loathing Germans. They're embarrassed about their Germanhood, if that's a word, right? And this is reinforced over and over and over again by the cultural Marxists and by the trolls on the internet. For example, if you go on to a certain World War II or especially German warfare, Eastern Front, Soviet Red Army versus the German here, the German Army, the German Wehrmacht, you will find, oftentimes, you will find these trolls there, right? And people could just be having a civil discussion. They may be talking about the relative merits of the German Messerschmitt 109 fighter plane or the German Focke-Wulf 190 fighter plane. They may be talking about the relative merits of the Panther tank and which tank had a better cannon. Was it the Panther or the Tiger tank with the 88mm cannon? And suddenly, out of the blue, you'll have one or more trolls screaming, "War crimes, atrocities, war crimes, Holocaust, war crimes. There were no good Germans. There were only bad Germans. War crimes. You're all anti-Semites. You shouldn't be talking about the Germans like this. You shouldn't be saying there were good German commanders. You shouldn't be saying there were good German soldiers who were just fighting for their country." Tip there. That's what this is all about. Because if we start to humanize the Germans, if we start to realize that, you know, it's a historical fact, Stalin was going to attack the Germans. It was only a matter of time. The plans were all in place. Hitler beat him to the punch. That was what happened, folks, all right? The Soviet Red Army was poised to invade Europe, but the Germans beat him to the punch, okay? So that is a historical fact that even Russian historians are now talking about. So they must always maintain this narrative of there were no good Germans, there were only evil, mass-murdering, genocidal, sewer scum Germans who did horrible, atrocious things. You start talking about, yeah, but what about what the Royal Air Force did to Dresden, firebombing it, when there were millions of refugees fleeing the rapacious, murderous Soviet Red Army? Anti-Semitism, anti-Semite. Anti-Semite, anti-Semite, war crimes, war crimes, right? You can't reason with these people. And that's the whole purpose. It's to reduce everything to this highly charged, highly emotional rant where if someone tries to speak up and say, "Hey, wait a minute, back off, clown. We're just talking about the relative merits of the Soviet Red Army T-34 tank and the German, you know, Panther tank. Atrocities, war crimes. All Germans, bad. Now, wait a minute, we're just talking about, you know, which German commanders were really good on the Eastern Front and in North Africa. War crimes, war crimes, war crimes. You're anti-Semites. You hate Jews." You see how that works? So even in a generic field like the Second World War, one cannot even have a basic discussion free from rancor, free from resentment, free from the piling on of all this hate and abuse and vitriol. And it's always coming from the same source. Because, again, we cannot humanize the Germans. We cannot say, you know what, they're fighting for their own country, being hemmed in by, you know, on both sides and on multiple sides. They're being hammered day and night, Operation Point Blank, a day-night bombing by the American Air Forces and the British RAF Bomber Command, just wiping one German city, village, and town out after another, many of which have had absolutely no strategic value. The Dam Busters that became famous, the RAF squadron known as the Dam Busters, they destroyed dams which flooded out the Ruhr and just basically drowned countless people. And to this day, these Dam Busters and the squadron that's taken on the name, the Dam Buster Squadron, its successor, they're looked on as great heroes, right? Because we can never talk about what happened to the Germans. We can never talk about how they were pulled kicking and screaming into the First World War, how the Admiralty blockade perpetrated by First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, starved millions of Germans between the First and Second World War. We can't talk about the onerous war reparations heaped upon Germany in the aftermath of World War I at the so-called Paris Peace Conference, the Treaty of Versailles, all these onerous war reparations, and this collective admission on the Germans' part of war guilt, which they later foisted upon the Germans again in the aftermath of World War II. So I'm making a point here. This is how you wind up with shame-based Germans who just cringe in terror when the subject of World War II was brought up. Even if you're talking about the Pacific Theater, even if you're talking about the Japanese and the Chinese duking it out, even if you talk about the Australians that are fighting against the Japanese in the Kokoda Track or, you know, Saddleburg or some other campaign in New Guinea. Just the fact that you're talking about the Second World War terrifies the hell out of them. And then when you go online, you talk about World War II, you talk about the Germans, you talk about the bravery of the German soldiers, you talk about the extremely high level of competence of many of the German commanders at all levels. Oftentimes, you'll just get nothing but hate from all these trolls. Because we cannot humanize them. We can only demonize them. When we begin to humanize the Germans, then the whole narrative falls apart. Then they just become normal people who were trying to keep the Soviet Red Army, the Red Hordes, out of Europe, which is what they were doing, trying to do. And look what happened with the guy who later became a field marshal for the Soviet Red Army, Georgi Zhukov, and he became so popular as a result of his victories and successes in World War II that Khrushchev, among others, kicked him to the curb. But Georgi Zhukov, prior to the Operation Barbarossa, the commencement of the German attack against Eurasia, Soviet Russia. Now think about the scale of that, folks. Think about all the way from the Baltic all the way down to like the Crimea. Just think about the scale, okay? When you hear American establishment historians like Stephen Ambrose, he was the official biographer of Dwight Eisenhower, a flunky if there ever was one. Stephen Ambrose wrote the Band of Brothers book, which became a well-known, very popular TV show, right? Miniseries. And Stephen Ambrose gets all emotional when he talked about the Normandy invasion, D-Day. He would go, it was the single most important thing that happened in all of World War II. And he'd start weeping and crying, shut up. Well, he's dead now, but wherever he is, he can still shut up. That was like, what, five divisions hitting the beaches and then three airborne divisions. And throw in some mixed parachute, glider units, etc., special ops units. Still, that was small potatoes compared to some of the titanic battles in the Eastern Front. In campaigns and battles involving millions of men and thousands of tanks, how could anyone possibly compare the Normandy invasion to, say, the Battle of Kursk or Stalingrad or the destruction of Army Group German Army Group Center. We're talking just mass carnage on a Eurasian continental scale, right? And getting back to Georgi Zhukov, and I know I'm belaboring the point, but there's a reason for this. Georgi Zhukov, with his own intel networks, was getting very strong indications the Germans were set to attack. They were going to attack, and this is, June 21st, June 20th, 1941. Hitler and, not Hitler, rather, but Stalin and the Stavka, the Soviet Red Army High Command, they completely rebuffed Zhukov. You know, he was still pretty much a nobody at the time. And they didn't just rebuff him because he was a nobody. It was because, without realizing it, Zhukov was stepping on Stavka and Stalin's toes. Because when he was being critical of their dispositions, which were very poor when it came to rebuffing an all-out German attack, he didn't realize that the Soviet Red Army dispositions were based on their own impending attack against the West. Their dispositions, the way their armies and divisions were allocated, was based on a future impending attack against Europe. But Georgi Zhukov did not know that at the time, so he was rebuffed. The point of relevance, folks, is if the Germans did not invade Soviet Russia, the Soviet Union, the Ukraine, all that, the Soviet Red Army would have invaded Central and Western Europe, Eastern Europe. It was only a matter of time. The Soviet Nazi non-aggression pact was meant to give both Stalin and Hitler, in their respective spheres of influence, time. Okay? Time. So, getting back to the self-loathing Germans, well, they don't want to hear any of that, because all that leads back to all the shaming and the guilting, guilting, that's been imposed upon the Germans. And now you have these young kids, but they have no reference point, these young kids today from Germany. They're just completely brainwashed. Now, you know, you speak to the older Germans, they know what's going on, okay? They're not going to say what they know is going on, but they know what's going on. They know what's happened, right? And the point of relevance to all this is some dingleberry accused me of being a self, didn't come out and call me this, but the inference was clear. I'm a self-loathing Filipino. I'm a self-loathing Filipino because I keep standing up for white people who their culture is being destroyed. And because of the, you know, all these immigrants, the immigrant invasion, immigrant rape invasion that's going on all over the Western world, right? And because I call that out and I say that it's wrong and it's part of the Coudenhove-Kalergi plan to thoroughly subjugate what's left of the civilized world and just turn loose all these entity-infested immigrants that are just attacking and raping everybody. Not all of them, okay, throwing, you know, the trolls a bone, but a great many of them. And there's article after article, newspaper article after newspaper article, clearly in Europe, in England, in Australia, all over the place. It's an immigrant crime wave, right? But because I call that out, suddenly I just hate myself because I hate the fact that I'm a Filipino and I wish I was white, right? This is the kind of idiocy. And but notice the feeble, flaccid attempt, pardon my Anunnaki, to try to frame the debate, to try to maintain, you know, a control of the narrative, right? See, because say if I'm calling out the Clintons for being just the career criminals and the evil people they are. It's like this algorithmic program kicks in. Oh, you're just like a right-wing Republican, yada, yada, yada. Never mind that I call out Trump for being, you know, the bitch of the tribalist collectivists and have done pretty much from the start, right? That's beside the point. Let's all keep this, again, at an highly emotionally charged kind of echo chamber, where there's just nothing but insults and yelling and screaming going on, no logic, nothing meaningful being exchanged. Hey, pal, we're just talking about the relative merits of, you know, the British Supermarine Spitfire fighter plane and the German Messerschmitt 109 during the Battle of Britain. War crimes, anti-Semitism, anti-Semitism. We can't even talk about two different fighter planes without these trolls popping up and freaking out because, again, we're humanizing the Germans. We're humanizing the fighter pilots, right? And so when I start calling out the tribalist collectivists for turning loose these hordes of these raping immigrants, these murdering immigrants, oh, suddenly I'm a self-loathing Filipino. Well, let me read you an article from a self-loathing Sudanese. I think this is very interesting. This is from the Daily Mail in Australia, dailymail.co.uk, and I'll explain the context and the background of this. And the headline reads, "We're sick and tired of excuses. Athlete who was the victim of a violent machete attack slams police for saying there are, quote, no African gangs in Melbourne, unquote, as immoral, inexplicable, and completely false. Nelly Yoa, that's N-E-L-L-Y, surname Y-O-A, a Sudanese athlete and youth worker, says Melbourne has a gang issue. He wrote an aggressive opinion piece where he slammed recent claims by politicians and police. Mr. Yoa said African youths are running rampant, but there is ways it can be fixed." Okay, I'm reading from the article. It was dated January 2nd, 2018, written by Josh Hanrahan for Daily Mail Australia. And since this article has come out, the corporate media has raked this brave Sudanese man over the coals. I'm having a gender fluid moment, folks. I have a man love crush on this Sudanese man for being brave, for standing up, for calling out the friggin' Sudanese gangs that are going crazy and running amok, which were being gaslighted into believing that these African gangs don't exist. But let me read the article, okay? "A Sudanese man who works closely with troubled youths says there's a real problem with African gangs in Melbourne. Nelly Yoa, a professional athlete who trialed for leading English soccer teams before becoming a youth worker, slammed claims gangs are not running rampant. Mr. Yoa, who was himself the victim of a violent machete attack in 2011, hit out at politicians and police in an aggressive opinion piece for The Age on Tuesday." The Age is an online website magazine. "Following a spate of gang violence across Melbourne's west in recent weeks, Mr. Yoa says it's time to admit there is, quote, an issue with Sudanese gangs, but that it can be fixed. Nelly Yoa, pictured, a professional athlete who trialed for leading English soccer teams before becoming a youth worker, has slammed claims gangs are not a problem in Melbourne. After being tormented by the Apex gang for a number of years, the city has in recent times also faced the rise of the so-called Menace to Society gang." Who comes up with these names? "Mr. Yoa, who currently plays for Collingwood in the Victorian Football League, said he was left, quote, furious and in disbelief, unquote, after authorities said Sudanese gangs didn't exist. Nobody should ever try and cover up or defend this unacceptable behavior. To do so is immoral and inexplicable. It is a fact that South Sudanese are overrepresented in crime statistics and are causing great harm and fear across communities in Melbourne. He himself has been on the end of gang violence, being hacked with a machete as a brawl broke out at a Sudanese beauty pageant in 2011. With injuries so severe, he was confined to a wheelchair. The incident cost Mr. Yoa his professional contract with Melbourne Victory." Okay, let me read that part again. It's poignant, okay? "He himself has been on the end of gang violence, being hacked with a machete as a brawl broke out at a Sudanese beauty pageant in 2011. I mean, I can think of a lot of places for a brawl to break out. Pubs, football matches, baseball games, you know, back when they had doubleheaders on those hot weekend days in Oakland Coliseum, you know, people drinking beer from like 10 a.m. on, I saw a lot of fights, and I saw a lot of fights at concerts, et cetera, et cetera. A fighter at a beauty pageant? Never heard of it. Leave it to the Sudanese. He himself has been on the end of gang violence being hacked with a machete as a brawl broke out at a Sudanese beauty pageant in 2011, with injuries so severe he was confined to a wheelchair. The incident cost Mr. Yoa his professional contract with Melbourne Victory, right? So his football career went out the window because some whack job Sudanese tried to lop his head off with a machete. The article goes on to say, having fled war-torn South Sudan in 2003 for a better life, Mr. Yoa said the actions of these gangs made him, quote, ashamed to call himself Sudanese. Melburnians are sick and tired of excuses. We've got to make sure people are held accountable. And there's a bunch of pictures in this article that shows the aftermath of damage meted out by these Sudanese gangs. Some of you out there are familiar with what an Airbnb is. An Airbnb is a property. Say you want to rent it for a night or 5 nights or 2 weeks. You just go online to your local Airbnb or wherever you want to visit, and then you find a place that fits your budget and location and, you know, quality, etc., etc., and you rent yourself out a place. There was a couple of young gals, I think they were like in their early 20s, they rented themselves out of Airbnb, and they're just kicking back, and next thing you know, a bunch of these Sudanese are trying to break in into this Airbnb property, right? And they're thrashing the place. There's videos of Sudanese women just thrashing a store for no reason, just thrashing it. We are very concerned at the growing gang violence and lawlessness in Victoria, in particular in Melbourne. I think that was a quote from Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. And he's trying to pass the buck and blame it on the state government of Victoria. Classic example of buck passing. So this guy, Nelly Yoa, he must be a self-loathing Sudanese because he should be proud that some other Sudanese wants to hack him to pieces with a machete. I mean, what's wrong with him? Why does he hate himself so much? Why does he wish he was white? You know, because he's seeing all this stuff go on around him. He must think he's white. See, that's the kind of mentality, the juvenile arrested development, basically gaslighting insanity that we're dealing with. When we're having the media, when we're having the politicians, when we're having the highest law enforcement authorities in the state of Victoria say, there is no gang problem. There is no African Sudanese gang problem. Okay, folks, there's a term for that. It's called gaslighting. Okay? It's gaslighting. When all this is going on, when there's all this video just showing hordes, hundreds of these Sudanese just running amok in St. Kilda Beach a couple of weeks ago. They're just people out there. St. Kilda is a popular beach in Victoria. World famous, actually. People go there from all over the world just to kick back and catch some rays. Next thing you know, just like a swarm of locusts descending upon the beachgoers in the form of these Sudanese, hundreds of them, just attacking people, committing acts of vandalism, causing problems for no reason, no apparent reason. But, you know what? Despite all the videotape, despite all the people that have been injured, who've gone public, who've shown their injuries on social media, despite all the medical records showing that these people have been attacked and injured, oh no, none of that's happening. It's not real. Racism, and then they wheel out these droid Sudanese community leaders saying, oh, this is just racism. Nothing like this is occurring. And of course, the media plays that up. That's gaslighting, folks. Now, notice in the article that Nelly Yoa said South Sudanese. That's a key point, because there's only been a South Sudan since 2011. There's been a decades-long civil war, very similar to in other places in sub-Saharan Africa, where you have this tribal conflict between one faction of of natives pitted against another, and they just war against each other relentlessly for decades. So we're talking multiple generations, right, of Sudanese who've known nothing but war, dislocation, violence, gang rape. And then what they do is, see, South Sudan was created in 2011, so they take all these people from a land that's been just hammered by warfare for decades, to the point where multiple generations, all they know over there is war. You pluck them out en masse, and no one can tell me these guys just rocked up to a travel agency in Sudan and said, oh yeah, we all want to go to Australia, we all want to go to Canada. Just type in Sudanese or Somali flash mobs in YouTube and just see, whether it's in Ontario, Canada, all these other places, you have these flash mobs of either Sudanese, Somalis, etc., just running amok. And it's asymmetrical warfare. It's proxy warfare. These are what they used to call shock troops. Shock troops. And because places like Australia and Canada have been disarmed, right? You know, take the time to study the Martin Bryant case. Martin Bryant was a mentally retarded boy, about an IQ of about 60 or less. And he was the patsy, the fall guy, for a mass shooting in Port Arthur, Tasmania, which became the justification for completely disarming Australia. Because they don't have a Bill of Rights in Australia, folks, right? And many of the victims at Port Arthur were killed with headshots. And once again, never mind all the eyewitnesses who saw multiple shooters with high-powered rifles, right, shooting from various locations, never mind all of that. And the fact that so many of the victims at Port Arthur were killed by headshots. In combat, there's like a 3-to-1 ratio wounded to killed, at least. And yet, we're supposed to believe that this mentally retarded boy would not only have such a high killed-to-wounded ratio, but most of his killed, most of the people he took out, were killed with headshots. So we're supposed to believe a mentally retarded boy has the shooting ability of an SAS shooter. Okay, that's ridiculous. Okay. But one thing necessarily follows another. One thing necessarily follows another. You have the Port Arthur gun control, and then you have the Australians largely disarmed, and then now they're bringing in all these people from war-torn countries. And I'm not leaving the Somali land pirates out of the equation. You've heard of Somali sea pirates. Well, there's Somali land pirates. There was a Somali land pirate who tried to rape a pregnant woman in Italy the other day. It just came out in the news. A woman was in labor, in the process of giving birth in a hospital, and somehow the Somali land pirate gets in there into her like birthing ward and tries to rape her. This is the kind of mentality, the kind of entity infestation we're talking about, folks. And we're being gaslighted. We're being told it's not happening. You're just being a racist. Or in my case, I'm just being like a self-loathing Filipino who wishes I was white, right? It's just a big joke is what it is.
And it's not just the Sudanese or the Somalis. It's the Eritreans. That whole Horn of Africa area has just seen nothing but conflict and war and disillusion and rape and just impoverishment. And you're going to take people out of there and then you're going to put them in a place like Toronto or Melbourne where there are these huge shopping malls where there's these like clean, pristine, relatively speaking, streets and parks and beaches and museums. You talk about a culture clash, and it's supposed to be literally a culture clash.
But I'll tell you something about the people in Australia. The people in Australia are tough. They were outnumbered 5-to-1 on the Kokoda track. What we would call militia. What we would call like National Guard or reservists, the 39th Militia Battalion, held the line against the spearhead of the Japanese advance in the Kokoda Track. And the militia were looked down upon by the regular Australian army for whatever reason. But they held the line, a brilliant fighting retreat that gave time for what became known as Maroubra Force to come in and also fight an epic delaying action, epic strategic withdrawal, which allowed time for the Australians to bring up more troops. So it was a campaign that was interfered with by General MacArthur, a bungling at the highest levels by the U.S. Air Force, Army Air Force. I'm not going to get into it, but, you know, the Australians were not well served by their American allies. That victory was almost wholly due to the fighting spirit of the Australian soldiers, the diggers and the militiamen. And then you look at the
Burma-Thailand Railroad
that the Japanese Imperial Army forced the POWs to build in the jungle fastnesses of Thailand and Burma. Thousands upon thousands of prisoners of war died. Many, many, many British soldiers died. And that movie, The Bridge on the River Kwai, was a joke. The British commander actually stood up for his men. It was just another example, in my estimation, of just taking someone with a good reputation and utterly destroying it, which is, you know, the stock and trade of some of these people. But the point of relevance is that many more British soldiers died building that Thailand to Burma railroad in comparison to Australian soldiers. Now, why is that? Because Australian soldiers in World War II did not operate under a class system. They didn't, you know, have these officers looking down at them. When they're all stuck in the same problem together, they all stuck with each other. It's called mateship in Australia. That was something that was lacking with the British for the most part, which is one of the main reasons why so many British officers died, because they set themselves apart immediately from the enlisted British soldiers. They wanted nothing to do with them. And so there was no one to help them around, no one to help pull them through. Whereas the Australians, officer, enlisted man, NCO, didn't matter. They were all in it together. It's called mateship. And not many people realize this. The very first German setback in World War II was meted out by Australian soldiers. When Rommel made his first attack on Tobruk, he was thoroughly rebuffed. Two attacks on Tobruk, and he was rebuffed, and then he had to settle down into a long siege. And those were Australian soldiers that did the rebuffing, okay? The very first victory in the Pacific was conducted by Australian soldiers. So the point of relevance is the Australians are tough people, and even though they've been largely disarmed, they're just not going to roll over and put up with all this crap. And there's another thing, too. In America, they've tried to disarm the people, but they have not been able to do so up till now, right? And here's the problem that these Sudanese Somali gangs, and again, just Google or go on YouTube, you know, Somali flash mob, Sudanese flash mob, immigrant flash mob, whatever. You will see video in Europe of hundreds of immigrants from Muslim countries, African countries, etc. And they're all mindlessly chasing a train, a locomotive, and throwing sticks, bottles, rocks, everything you can think of at the train, right? And it's like they just can't help themselves. A train is pretty much an inanimate object. There happens to be people in it, people taking video, right? But it doesn't matter. It's like it's a moving target. It triggered them, and they're going to attack it. And then you see video of them running amok through stores, running amok through beaches. Now, getting back to America, see, the problem that these gangs are going to have is that, let's say that a bunch of Sudanese or Somalis try to vandalize a hardware store. And as far as all you apologists and gaslighters are out there concerned, let me spell it out for you, okay? These Sudanese gang members, these Somali land pirates, they don't care if you're Sudanese. They don't even care if you're Somali. If they want to hack at you with a machete, they'll do so. They'll attack your place of business, during business hours, and when it's closed. They will do home invasions. Just ask those two girls that were in the Airbnb rental when suddenly these Sudanese were trying to break the windows and crash the door down to get to them.
These Sudanese and Somalis will attack people of any race. It doesn't matter. So this whole race argument, oh, you're racist for bringing this up, is absolutely, patently absurd and can only come from the mind of a severely entity-infested person, as far as I'm concerned.
They do not discriminate. They will attack anybody. I'm reminded of that scene in The Terminator, you know, where Michael, the Michael Biehn character, is saying, it's not going to stop. They're going to come after her, you know. Well, getting back to America, see, the difference is, if those Somali land pirates, if those Sudanese gangs, or these other Sharia-type groups from the Muslim countries, from Pakistan and elsewhere, if they try to cause trouble, and they've been causing a lot of trouble, but so far they've been lucky, if they try to cause trouble in a store that happens to have people armed and know how to defend themselves, they're going to run into a world of hurt. Because the difference between Australia, the UK, Canada, Europe, is that in America, they're armed to the teeth. And in that hardware store I was talking about, in a hypothetical example, there could be an old guy working in the back of the store. And the old guy has a nickname. His nickname is Gunny. Because for 25 years, he was a gunnery sergeant in the United States Marine Corps, right? He's an expert with weapons. He's going to come out of the back of the store, and he's going to go bang, 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 bang. No more Somali land pirate issues. No more Sudanese gang issues. And it's going to be like that all over the U.S. because they're still armed over there. And nothing they can do will disarm the Americans. It ain't going to happen. There's too many. There's too many ex-Marines, too many ex-Army, too many Air Force, Coast Guardsmen, etc., etc., and just plain old woodsmen, plain old frontiermen-type people and frontier-type women who know to how to protect themselves. So these flash mobs, they're not going to be able to get away with all this crap the way they do in the Commonwealth countries and in the UK, Canada. Jeez, look what's going on in Europe and so many places. No-go zone. Sweden, no-go zone.
Right now, I'm going to read a couple of things to show the hypocrisy that we're talking about and show the contrast of how it's done in one country and then how it's being done in Australia and the irony involved, and I'll get to that. Okay, here's an article from MSN.com, and it's also from The Age. Victoria's most senior police officer has rubbished suggestions of, quote, an African gang crisis, even asking a reporter, how long since you've been out for dinner, in at times an extraordinary press conference. Chief Commissioner Graham Ashton, in his first public appearance since returning from a six-week period of sick leave on Monday, also revealed people of African origin had been subject to racially motivated death threats amid a political storm regarding youth crime. We're supposed to feel sorry for them, right? Flanked by African leaders from across Victoria, token African leaders, Mr. Ashton announced that a community task force would be formed to work with police in addressing a surge of what he described as public order offenses over the past month. Now, let me interject something, too. A few weeks ago, the Victoria Police in Melbourne, they complained about how, oh, these Sudanese gangs, they ambushed us. They led us into these alleyways and these constricted streets, and, you know, we couldn't back out, and we were surrounded by them, and we're supposed to feel sorry for them. when we know that on their dashboards they have grids, computerized grids of all the streets they patrol. They're in constant radio communications. They patrol those streets all the time. And we're supposed to believe it's like a Black Hawk Down situation. They just get ambushed by a bunch of Sudanese African gangs, and they don't know, you know, what they're doing. They don't know how it happened. They don't, you know how they could prevent it from happening again, right? So again, you have the dichotomy at work, where a few weeks back, the police are saying, "Oh, these African gangs, they surprised us. They ambushed us in a place that's supposed to be as familiar as the back of the cop's hands. These Melbourne streets." Somehow, they got suckered into an ambush by these African gangs. But on the other hand, Victoria's most senior police officer is saying there is no African gang crisis. You see how that works, right? Flanked by African leaders from across Victoria, Mr. Ashton announced that a community task force would be formed to work with police in addressing a surge of what he described as public order offenses over the past month. "I've heard people say that Victoria is not a safe place to live," he said. "That's complete and utter garbage. There are people who have been affected by crime, and that's always been the case, and that's the case in every city in Australia, and the same as every city in the world." That's his equivocation. "Victoria is one of the safest places in the world to live, and the sort of concept that somehow it's unsafe to go out for dinner. How long since you've been out for dinner?" After the reporter answered that she didn't go out for dinner and cooked at home, a response that resulted in the room erupting in laughter, Mr. Ashton continued, "I think everyone in this room would go out for dinner. I don't think anyone is sitting at home cowering with the sheets over their heads." Well, unless you're a couple of young girls that rented out an Airbnb, and Sudanese gangs are trying to break the door down and trying to smash the windows to get in at them. Mr. Ashton clarified that he was not saying Mr. Dutton's comment was complete and utter garbage, and that he did not want to enter the political debate. He said the offending had been street gang related, and that police were focused on protecting the community, but that the coverage of African youth crime in the past month had been counterproductive. "If you put it in the context, you've got a few hundred offenders engaged in offending in a city of 4.5 million people." Well, shit, that's a lot of people, if you ask me. 400, at least. "We have some young people that are engaging in gang-related behaviors. We're not shying away from that, but I think it's important we keep it in perspective." Talk about equivocation. Talk about passing the buck. Okay, now let me read you another article from the Times of Israel. This is from 7 June 2012, okay? And the byline reads, 52% of Israeli Jews agree African migrants are a cancer, unquote. 52% of Jewish Israelis identify with the statement by member of Knesset, that's the Israeli parliament, Miri Regev. She's the culture minister, right? 52% of Jewish Israelis identify with a statement by member of Knesset Miri Regev last month that African migrants are, quote, a cancer in the body of the nation, and over a third condone anti-migrant violence, according to the Israel Democracy Institute Peace Index for May 2012. Okay, right off the bat, you have utter hypocrisy, okay, because the Codenhove Kalergi plan, which is being implemented by all these immigration bureaucrats in all the Western countries, many of them, just virtually all of them, tribalist collectivists that have the responsibility of the immigration in the various countries, they're flooding these countries with African migrants, with Pakistanis, et cetera, right? But in Israel, a third of the people say it's okay to attack the migrants. That's a good thing. 52% of the Israelis, the Jewish Israelis, say that they agree with the culture minister that African migrants are a cancer in the body, unquote, right? This is the Times of Israel. So, again, we have this dichotomy at work where everywhere else in the world, it's racist, it's bigoted, it's Islamophobic, it's anti-African to even suggest there's a gang problem, to even suggest there's an immigrant crime wave. And then you have the bought and paid for media come on, and they roll out all these token African community leaders in all these different countries where there's all this African crime going on. And they make all these comments about how they're being racially profiled, they're being victimized, we're supposed to feel sorry for them. People are making a big deal about something that's not real, and so we have to feel sorry for them because now they're being subjected to racism, yada, yada, yada. The media is going along with it. Media is making fun of people who say that there's an African gang problem. Oh, but in Israel, a third of the people say, oh, just attack the migrants. Just attack them. And you know what? I kind of have my doubts that there are Somali land pirates running amok in Israel. I'm sorry. And I kind of have my doubts that there's Sudanese gangs running amok in Israel. Because everyone over there is armed to the teeth. No gun control there. Because it's compulsory. If you're an Israeli, you're going to join the... You're not going to join. You are compelled to join the Israeli Defense Force at some point in your career. And you have people walking the streets with automatic weapons. Soldiers, policemen. No, I don't think Somali land pirates are running amok. Once in a while, because these, you know, a lot of these entity-infested African migrants, they can't help it. They just have to attack somebody. There's a story of an 82-year-old Israeli woman that was attacked by an Eritrean, brutally beaten and raped. This happened, you know, some time ago. So those things do happen. And when I'm just surprised they even let them in the country, even knowing how strict their... how strict their immigration laws are. And in a related context, here's an interesting story from SputnikNews.com. And the byline reads, he's a goy from Kenya, Jewish convert with valid visa, denied entry to Israel. A Kenyan citizen was recently detained at the airport and deported from Israel despite having a valid tourist visa. Yehuda Kamani, a 31-year-old Jewish convert, believed he had the permission of the Israeli ambassador in Nairobi to study at a conservative yeshiva in Israel, but when he arrived at Ben-Gurion Airport in mid-December to begin his studies, he found border authorities had different ideas. Kamani was detained and not allowed to contact his sponsors in Israel, according to Haaretz, and put on a plane to Ethiopia, GTFO, in other words. The following morning, according to the Jerusalem Post, officials feared he would remain illegally in the country after his three-month visa expired. And in Australia, they have these Sudanese gang members, apex gang members. They've been arrested time and again for violent crimes, for vandalism, for armed assault, for burglary, felonious assault, and it's like it's a big political issue whether they could even deport these guys, right? And the Israelis, they're just kicking these guys out, not even letting him in the country. According to the Jerusalem Post, officials feared he would remain illegally in the country after his three-month visa expired. Why Kamani was suspected of such duplicity, the Interior Ministry never said. Though Kamani hails from Kenya, since 2010, he has been a member of a Ugandan community of Jewish converts called the Abu Yadaya, whose Jewish status with regards to the Jewish state is still in limbo. The reason for that is they're black and, you know, the Jews don't want to recognize them. Although the Abu Yadaya ceased practicing Christianity and began observing Jewish customs nearly a century ago, only in 2002 did they receive official conversion by a conservative rabbi. Another group converted in 2008, and the community today numbers between 1,500 and 2,000 members. Abu Yadaya status with Israel is a confused mess. Although Birthright recognizes them as Jewish, the Jewish Agency only recognizes converts since 2009 as Jews since that is when they joined the World Conservative Movement. However, the Israeli Interior Ministry, which gets the last word on who and who is and who is not Jewish, and thus entitled to immigrate to Israel by the law of return, does not currently recognize Abu Yadayas as Jews. It was on that note that Amos Arbel, director of the ministry's Population Registry and Status Department, replied to questions about Kamani's situation by saying, according to Haaretz, sorry to say this, but for us, He is a goy from Kenya. Okay, so they're saying that this black guy, he's probably black, who converted to Judaism, is not a Jew, and they're comparing him to what they consider to be the worst of the worst, which is a goy. So they're saying this black guy, who thinks he's a Jew, well, he's just a goy from Kenya, right? Sorry to say this, but for us, he is a goy from Kenya. And you know what? The chutzpah and all that, the refreshing honesty I like. Okay? You know, it's like I don't have to like what they do. I don't have to, you know, go along with what they do. But you know what? There's something to be said by not giving a rat's ass what other people think, right? And see, what they've managed to do, the tribalist collectivists, is they can be the most apartheid racist country in the world, bar none. But they make everyone else kind of kowtow and bow down and be all politically correct. And not worry about offending people, right? And here they are. He's just saying, oh, no, we're not going to let this guy in. A, he's not a Jew. We don't recognize him as a Jew. And B, he's just a goy from Kenya. Since the Interior Ministry doesn't consider Kamani to be Jewish and yeshivas are non-degree conferring institutions, Arbel explained that Kamani's visa was denied because only Jewish applicants are given visas to study at such institutions. This ignores the fact, of course, that Kamani's visa was approved and stamped by the Israeli consulate in Nairobi in November, the Jerusalem Post reported in December. And here's the kicker. The guy says, Amos Arbel, director of the ministry's population registry and status department, he says, do you want half of Africa coming here? With this line, Arbel fired back at critics of Kamani's deportation, touching on a much larger issue at hand, Israel's troubled relationship with African immigrants and Mizrahi Jews. On Wednesday, the Israeli cabinet approved a plan and budget to deport 35,000 African immigrants by the end of March, according to the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, targeting primarily asylum seekers from Sudan and Eritrea. Migrants who do not voluntarily exit the country or accept a $3,500 settlement to do so will be detained in a Negev prison facility, perhaps indefinitely, according to the Jerusalem Post. Israel has approved only 1% of all asylum requests. I doubt that, seriously. Maybe 0.001%, according to the Jerusalem Post. Deportees will be sent to either Uganda or Rwanda, part of a tactic to sidestep international laws that bar repatriation of refugees to the country from which they are fleeing. According to the Jerusalem Post, the Rwandan government will receive $5,000 per refugee they accept, which is no big deal because they get all that money from the Americans anyway. However, if deported to Central Africa, the refugees' situation may be a little better than if they were sent home. One Eritrean merchant described the predicament in no uncertain terms. If I am forced to go to Rwanda, I will die, he said, according to the Jerusalem Post. I know of people who went there, and we never heard from them again. They are given no rights and have no status. Oh, really? You mean black people in Rwanda, you know, they don't cut any slack from, like, dark black people from Eritrea? That's interesting. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu boasted that Israel has already deported 20,000 African migrants, 4,000 of them in 2017. Having completed the intricate barrier along the Sinai border with Egypt, Netanyahu noted that no, quote, infiltrators had crossed the border in 2017 and that the mission now is to deport the rest, referring to the 40,000 remaining refugees. I just have to laugh at the hypocrisy of it. Okay, because you read the comments, you listen to the comments of Barbara Lerner Specter, I forget the name of the Jewish immigration bureaucrat in the UK under Blair, Barbara somebody or other. She was a tribalist collectivist. She's the one that really kicked into high gear. I mean, people from the subcontinent and Africa have been coming to the UK for a long time, but it really, really kicked off. Really, really kicked off, and it went into high gear when Tony Blair was in office. See, it's okay for them to flood the rest of the world with these Africans, but then when they get their backup, like this Arbel guy, right? He says, do you want half of Africa coming here? You see, it's a total disconnect. In Melbourne and Victoria, oh, you know,
The chief of police is making fun of people who ask, right? Meanwhile, the cops are complaining about being ambushed. And you actually see video of Australian cops being attacked by these Sudanese gangs, right? And you know what's happening. The cops are being told, I can't do an Australian accent, so I'll do an American accent. You're going to stand down, boy. You're going to stand down. Just suck it up. Just suck it up. You're going to let these Sudanese gangs beat on your ass. Right? In America, they would just, you know, the cops would just go nuts, shoot at them and whoever happened to be around also. But in Australia, oh, the cops just have to knuckle under, take a beating, and complain about being lured into traps and lured into ambushes. And when they're supposed to know these streets like the back of their hand, when they're supposed to have the whole street layout, you know, grid right there on their dashboards, on these computer screens, right? And meanwhile, the chief of police is saying, there's nothing to it. But meanwhile, in Israel, we're going to kick them all out. Oh, by the way, you know, if the citizens want to attack these African immigrants while they're at it, that's fine with us too. Everyone else? Oh, no, that's racism. Everyone else around the world, they don't exist. We're being gaslighted. There's no African gangs, despite all the videos showing them attacking people and thrashing stores and whatnot, right? So it's a weird fourth dimensional topsy-turvy thing that we're seeing right here. And if it seemed like I was belaboring the point, well, it's a point that needs to be belabored. Because, we see the dichotomy at work. The Israelis have no qualms, not even, forget about deporting them all. They don't even let them in. The ones that are already in, they're kicking out. But in Australia, even when they bust these Sudanese gang members, it's like it turns into a political issue to deport these guys, right? That just shows you the control exerted by the powers that be. Anyhow, my throat and my voice is going, has gone as far as it can go for the moment at the risk of any more heavy breathing. Perish the thought. I'm going to end this segment of the commentaries. And wherever you may be, dear listeners, whatever you may be doing, have a very pleasant time and we'll see you next time. Bye for now. Because this is a frequency war.